This is John McGuire, and you are listening to Pentimental on SyncBook Radio. Today, on episode number 18, we have joining us for a one-on-one conversation, applied scientist and author, Dr. Edmund Storms, as well as another one-on-one dialogue with cold fusion advocate and creator of ecatworld.com, Mr. Frank Ackland. On this episode, we will be discussing the science and politics surrounding what's popularly known as cold fusion, sometimes referred to now as low-energy nuclear reactions. Not only does cold fusion have the potential to change how energy is thought of and utilized in our industrialized civilization, but the story surrounding its discovery reminds us of the sometimes corruptible nature of institutionalized science that nowadays often seeks expediency and self-aggrandizement over commitment to fair play and the scientific method. And to speculate on a more metaphysical level, it was Carl Jung, in partnership with Nobel laureate and quantum physicist Wolfgang Pauli, who decided jointly that the atomic nucleus was an archetypal symbol of the transforming self, the very embodiment of individuation. In that sense, then, I think anyone who studies this topic to any degree is engaging with a type of exploration that is deeply personal. Thanks again to my guest this week, and thank you for listening. Joining me today on Pentimental is Frank Ackland. Frank created and maintains one of the premier advocacy sites for cold fusion, ecatworld.com, where daily news and opinion on the subject is aggregated in an effort to educate the public about the validity of low-energy nuclear reactions. So, Frank, thank you for being with me today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Starting out, can you give us a little bit more about your background, how you got interested in the science of cold fusion, and what motivated the construction of your website, ecatworld.com?
Sure, yeah, you know, I'm a real amateur. My interest in things related to energy, I guess, could go back to the 1970s oil crash when I was probably 10 years old or maybe less, and I can remember at the time just kind of wondering what would happen if energy became scarce or became so expensive that it kind of would bring the world to a crashing halt. And, you know, I was, as a boy, I didn't really think very much about it, but it was just kind of like one of those nagging worries that you would sometimes think about. And, you know, so as time went on, that kind of faded away because somehow the markets recovered and that we weren't queuing up for gasoline. I was raised in England, by the way, so that was where it was all happening. I remember back in the 1980s, as a young man now, I guess, I was interested and intrigued when they made the announcement about Pons and Fleischmann's cold fusion discovery. And I didn't follow it immensely, just but it was in the news, and I was really disappointed when things started going south for them. But then I've always kind of had just an interest in alternative forms of energy, partly because I felt like there's got to be something better than, you know, the fossil fuels that we're basically living on still. And, you know, I'm interested in solar and wind and, you know, the possibilities that they would offer. But then I was always thought, well, what if there was actually something very unique and different and real that could actually get things moving in a brand new direction. And so that's kind of what got me interested when I heard about Rossi's reactor, that just some friends told me that something was going on there. And yeah, that was kind of the catalyst. Started looking into that and got the feeling that this was actually possible. Possibly something very important, and the more I looked into it, the more I got that kind of feeling that there really is something going on here. That was January 2011, and by April 2011, I decided, well, this is something interesting enough. I'd like more people to know about it, and that's what was my impetus for starting the ECAT World website. And it was April 2011 was the when we started, and I just kept going since then.
And did I give a pretty good overview of what is presented on the website? It's largely a news aggregator, would you call it that? Or
yeah, you know, anything that I find interesting, and I try and keep it up to date, you know, with current events and things. So yeah, you know, articles, events, people, or anything that's connected with the ECAT, with Cold Fusion, and even with related topics, other technologies we do cover sometimes. For example, brilliant light power is a topic that comes up quite frequently these days. And I'm interested in other possible avenues for better energy production and things like that. So, yeah.
Well, and for me, I view ECAT World, despite the name and what it implies, it's much more than just a fanboy site of energy policy. It does cover a wide, wide spectrum, very similar to Ruby Carrot's Cold Fusion Now, who's also in this on the same tier as you of providing really great material and oversight and content for people that are curious. And it's been a great just source of information. And the hot button topic has been the possible ECAT reactor for a while. So obviously you're going to gravitate on that. And
right.
So ECAT World is much more than what the name implies.
Yeah. I gave it the name ECAT World because that was kind of my initial interest. But, you know, as you go get into this and as you study more people, and it's not the only thing going on. But I do think, you know, all things told, I don't think we'd have this revived interest in LENR if it wasn't for the ECAT. So, you know, the ECAT, you could say, it's the catalyst that started a lot of the current interest in the field.
That's a very interesting way of looking at it. And yes, the synchronicity that its name would have that in there. And if it's catalyzing a discussion and opening up space for new things to thrive,
yeah,
that is like there's a value in it in and of itself. And I've always seen it that way. And that's why I've cared about the validity of it, but I don't put everything I believe into it. It's just like if it's good, if it works, fantastic. If not, there's so many other things to look forward to.
Exactly. I agree.
Now, before we get into any of that, let's talk about some of those other people that maybe you discovered when you started getting into the subject matter and like, who caught your attention was like, oh, wow, the evidence they produce or the way they argue for the subject or, you know, the way they've told the history of it. What books encouraged you or anything like that?
Well, I'm not so much a reader of books. Most of my reading is online, and it's usually with my time constraints and all other kinds of things that go on in my life, I don't really have time to sit down and read books as such, but I'm sort of an omnivore and a browser of a lot of different ideas. I'm interested in people who are seriously investigating LENR and those kinds of topics. I'm especially interested when anybody gets promising results in practical experiments. As far as theory goes, I really don't have a strong grasp of theoretical physics. And so I don't pretend to have a favorite theory. I'm more interested in practical, experimental evidence, which I think there's been a lot of over the years, not just since Ross's time, but since the Pons and Fleischmann time. It seems like there have been serious scientists who've got, you know, they've been able to see anomalous energy production, and anytime someone can do that, I think that I find that very interesting. And I guess one of the things that drives my desire to keep this website going is I just feel like this is something that people should know about. And why is there such a lack of interest amongst people who one would think would be interested in this phenomenon that is obviously been demonstrated time and time again? So it's almost like hoping that somehow more interest will be generated and, you know, get a bit of a snowball going, and we can make some kind of breakthrough where this is not forever on the fringes of science.
Yeah, and for me getting into this, I first stumbled across he's a pretty prolific YouTube poster named Alien Scientist.
Mm-hmm.
He's great. He produces a lot of stuff. And he's a great advocate for cold fusion, argues it very well. He mm-hmm. himself graduated with a physics degree, so he has some mm-hmm. concept of what he's talking about as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then I transitioned into Cold Fusion Now because he worked a bit with Ruby and I got in touch with that. And then I found some of like Ed Storms' lectures because Ed is truly eloquent and knows everything about the subject. He causes a lot of disagreement within the community because he's very staunch about, hey, I've read these things. This is what I know and this is what I believe. But if you want an overview, he's amazing. And from there, it's just that got me interested more and more. And I started reading the papers and I really got into what is the evidence for this. And there's a small cluster for me that just proves it all beyond a reasonable doubt. They found helium in many, mm-hmm. many experiments that were so well done, mm-hmm. impeccably done. Helium. The only way you're getting mm-hmm. helium from deuterium is fusion, period. There's also tritium that people like Ed Storms and Claydor and John Bachris discovered. So again, another clear nuclear product. There's transmutations going on in these yep. things. They found transmutations. But the kicker, the thing that makes everyone excited is of course the excess heat because right. it's producing nuclear levels of energy. That's why it was called cold fusion in the first place. Mm-hmm. When it first emerged, it just produced so much energy they didn't know what to call it because it was only on the nuclear spectrum. So even without the full evidence, they're like, well, the energy coming out is nuclear in levels. So what the hell, dude? What's it matter if it's nuclear or not? But of course, science is a very fickle thing, and maybe that's like where we can go into. And it's not that you have to be an expert on the entire story, but like, can you give an idea of what the Pons and Fleischmann affair was like? And what did that tell you about how science works and sort of how the public works?
Well, you know, at the time, I wasn't in the scientific literature. I never read a single paper that Pons and Fleischmann had written. It was just, oh, well, that's a disappointment. Sorry, that didn't work out. Well, maybe something will work out at some point. At the time, I just didn't dig into it enough, and it's only been since I started getting interested again in this field that, you know, you start looking at the evidence and the replications that have been made over the years, and kind of just you get to see that kind of disillusion with the mainstream scientific world is, I guess, my feeling. And I guess the hope, I guess, is always there that people will start seeing through some of these things and just look at things with an open mind and just really look at the evidence without being clouded by, you know, the media or public opinion. And I think if you do that, then you will realize that there's something important going on. Yeah, in the end, as far as I'm concerned, the overriding interest for me in this field is not just the science for the science sake, but practical applications of this technology, how it could solve so many of our problems that we have in the world and, you know, really, really make life better for people. That's really my most driving interest in this field.
And to really just put it as simply as possible for people who don't know what cold fusion is or hasn't listened to the other parts of this interview or whatever, basically, water is the fuel and it uses there's a solid state mechanism. Well, in certain systems, there's all sorts of different cold fusion systems, gas-loaded, water, whatever. But anyway, the basic theory is that this water is getting into this metal and fusing, but not producing any of the radiation that would come with typical hot fusion that would produce all sorts of neutrons right. and gammas that poison people and are dangerous to people, and that's why they cost billions of dollars to operate and run. It's this liberating thing in theory, and that if the heat is real, and so the question is, how do we harness it? And it's really ridiculous that they're still like, oh, the heat isn't real. The heat is real. So now how can we practically apply it? Why don't we just try to harness that right. and not worry about right. how it worked? Do we have to understand everything about it? No, we really don't. That's never how science has worked. And that's never mm-hmm. how even industry has worked. So electricity was brought about in a time way before man was ready for it and is still not ready for it, to be perfectly honest. So there's never a right time, but it's like, why not? Why not try? And that's why people are trying very seriously right now. And I have a lot of appreciation for people just like Brillouin or Martin Fleischmann Memorial Project. And even someone like Rossi, I don't know. It could be all a sham, but at least it's like creating the space for this discussion to happen again.
Yeah, I really, personally, I don't think Rossi is a sham. I think he's done something. I think he's figured out something. He's very secretive, of course, and that drives a lot of suspicion. But I think he is, in practical terms, probably the furthest ahead in this field. Now, whether this can be made into something commercial, something ubiquitous, which is his goal, you know, that remains to be seen. But, you know, if he can do it, I think other people can do it. I think through great study and great hard work, he's figured out something. But, you know, he's a pioneer. It's not always the pioneers who are the, you know, the commercial victors. So I think there's a lot that remains to be seen. But definitely, I think he's lit a spark, which there are certainly many people, there are people who are going after this very hard. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if there were other breakthroughs and other insights that people have that could really blow this wide open. So that wouldn't surprise me at all. But I'm in the same breath, we don't have a commercial product at the moment. We don't have a practical product at the moment on the market. So it's one of those feelings is, you know, you get a feeling that it could well blow open, but also you got to be realistic and say, we're still really in a very preliminary stage.
Very preliminary. We live in a very hype-driven world that still wants to think we're way closer to achieving something when we're still like in a different stage in what we believe to be. Maybe this is actually just a warm-up. And I think everyone's got the sense of that. And again, mentioning Ed Storms, his emphasis is so much recently on theory just because he wants to create a framework, get people thinking on, like, why are we building technology this way in line with theory? How can applied science and theory evolve side by side? But the truth is there's not enough money for the applied science. It doesn't exist right now. They've appealed to the Department of Defense, or I'm forgetting who reviewed the cold fusion reports off the top of my head, but it's been put in front of the federal government several times, and it's
yes.
Still hasn't gotten the momentum, even though anyone that reads those reports, it's as clear as day. They put all the best stuff in there, all the fundamental science is there, if people would just put their prejudice aside. But if people won't put their prejudice aside, let's put some more money into it. Let's take some small percentage from, say, the military budget, maybe, and spend it on something like energy development or infrastructure. And maybe it's a new energy and a new way for people to move into the future. And even if it fails, it's a worthy experiment, isn't it? Because we all know this is not working anymore.
Yeah, as far as funding goes, I really don't have a strong opinion on how that should happen. I would hope that this would be something that would not require massive budgets, as we've seen in the hot fusion field. It really shouldn't, from what we have learned so far. I would hope that there would be maybe philanthropists or maybe even businesses, or if you can't get public funds, I hope there would be some private funds out there that could fund, you know, even if it was a few hundred thousand dollars could go a long way in this field. But we see, you know, the people who are, you know, like the Martin Fleischmann group and other researchers who are doing it on a shoestring. They're just struggling to make a few thousand dollars just to carry on with some experiments. It's really kind of a shame.
And we're realizing with the great efforts that have been put forward by people who just worked as basically pariahs in secret, even though most of them are such well-established scientists and well-respected in their field. And the moment people know that, oh, you're working in cold fusion, they were made pariahs, or they had to do it sort of in their own labs or whatever.
Yep.
Anyway, through their efforts, we know a lot more about what's going on, but we still are so far away. But we're realizing like how sophisticated a process it is, because it's deceptive that in the 89 event, Pons and Fleischmann produced cold fusion in this test tube looking thing. It looked like a kid's toy. Uh-huh. And so everyone can believe that you're telling me you're creating a nuclear reaction in a test tube. That's ridiculous. Get the hell out of here. And it created a lot of like anger and disdain. Like, this cannot be happening. Now, it seems at a basic science level, yes, we can get the effect. It's small scales, but it's still like we don't understand it necessarily, because the surfaces of, say, like the metals that we're putting in interaction with hydrogen, deuterium, have to be looked at so closely. And it requires basically investments in nanotechnology and research that it's just not there right now. And people doing it in their labs, even though, you know, maybe they have good pensions or something, it's not enough. Mm-hmm. This equipment is so expensive. This is the world of science we live in, unfortunately. And it's just, there's momentum in certain directions like fusion and fossil fuels and nuclear power, like classical nuclear power, that what are we going to do, fill up the earth with more uranium rods? That's going to end. Even if it's better than fossil fuels in a way, that's going to end too, and maybe be even scarier. So we need to change. And yeah, like you mentioned earlier on, we have other options like solar and wind, and when applied in the right way, especially in like a small localized way where it's not dissipating all its energy across a huge grid, it can be very, very useful. A fellow named Mark Dancy. Mark Dancy's a great energy advocate. Super skeptical, very hard to convince of things, but very good in what he knows. And he focuses on solar, and like, there's so much there. But cold fusion is, I still think it's the best hope. It's like, I trust the science that's been done, and I would like to see more. And I think we'd all like to see more. But if what's there isn't convincing people yet, I don't know what else to say about it. I mean, the research stands on its own if you're unprejudiced enough to look at it.
Right. I think it would only take one or two or just someone who is well known and respected outside of this very small community to take an interest and to stand up and say, hey, why don't we look at this? I mean, it just seems like it's, like you've said, people are terrified to talk about it. Like you said, it's sort of a pariah. Hugh Price out of Cambridge University, he had a phrase for it. He wrote a very interesting article about it, and basically his phrase was the reputation trap. Basically, he was saying that cold fusion suffers from the curse of the reputation trap, meaning the discussion is so taboo that people steer clear of it just to avoid damaging their reputations. It's just something that cannot be said. And that's what cold fusion is. And it's just a shame because, like I said just a few minutes ago, is it would take just one person, a respected person who in the field of science, or it may not necessarily need to be science, but just someone who could stand up and say, hey, look, there's really something going on here and we ought to take a look at it. But if there is someone who has that level of respect, I suppose they could lose that respect in an instant if they just started talking about cold fusion. So that is the reputation trap.
And what's interesting is, I think in 2009, 60 Minutes ran another episode on cold fusion. I think that was the most recent time it's gotten mainstream attention. And in that episode, basically they bring on the arch skeptic, I'm forgetting his name, but his arguments against the phenomenon were just obviously shown their age and were impotent to answer any of the actual evidence that was presented to him. He just would say they're not measuring it correctly.
Right.
He's questioning Michael McCoubrey, who's an actual electrochemist. This person's a nuclear physicist who doesn't work with any of the shit that he works with every single day. And he's saying he's not measuring it correctly. This is the sort of hubris that exists in institutions, even scientific ones, and that this is what they can say. They haven't even been in the lab working on this stuff, and they can dismiss it offhand. That's anti-science. Anti-science. And so when I hear people talking like that, even if you disagree that cold fusion doesn't exist, please be familiar with what's been done in it. Please be familiar with what has been explained, what hasn't been explained, what can be explained with incorrect measurements. Because at some point that is just a tired argument. And it still can be applied, of course. There's been interesting research that's come up, experiments like the Parkhamov experiment. You could question that. It's boiling water, but you could say, well, what is going on there with the temperature and so on. But anyway, moving on, I just want to say that in response to you saying someone should stand up and say something, in that episode, Rob Duncan, who was a professor at Missouri, said, hey, I reviewed the paperwork for this episode. I reviewed the research, and it looks good. It looks really good.
Yes.
And he said, I don't know what this is. I don't know if we'll ever harness it for future energy. All I know is that it deserves way more attention, and it doesn't deserve pariah status. It's like a real science, and whatever it is, whatever it could and should be, doesn't even matter. It just needs to be established as fact in people's minds.
Yeah, I really appreciated what he did and what he's done since then. I don't think he's been... he's at Texas Tech now, and I think he's something like the vice president for research. He's not just there to do cold fusion, but I don't think he's lost interest, from what I can gather. But, you know, you do need people. You need people of courage, of conviction, and people who are not afraid to fall into that reputation trap. But that's just hard. It's hard to find people.
And amazingly, when the story first broke in 89, probably the biggest advocate for saying, hey, let's keep looking at this, was Julian Schwinger, QED fame, Nobel laureate. And he basically helped lay the entire foundation for quantum electrodynamics. And he produced a theory. It didn't stand the test of time, but at the same time, it's just like, hey, he came out and he didn't really give a damn what was going to happen. And like he actually, I think he resigned from, or he was expelled from some scientific club. It was news enough. Like there was some, his affiliation with cold fusion was enough for him to leave or for him to get kicked out. And so you saw immediately that like no one was, everyone was open to criticism and being labeled a pariah if you stood against the momentum of whatever that was. Yeah.
It's a real shame. And I you know, that's, like I said, that's part of my motivation is to try and find ways to let the light shine a bit more on this. However, I've got to say, I don't know if there's been a whole lot of progress, to be honest, outside the narrow, fairly closed community that follows Eleanor. Yeah, I mean, I think there's more interest than there has been, but in the big picture, it doesn't seem like a huge amount has changed.
No, we've managed to bring in a lot more people like you and I, Frank, just amateurs that are really interested in the future and making it a better place for people and trying to just spread good information, whatever they consider good information. And unfortunately, like, we don't hold sway with academicians and we don't hold sway with industrial science. We don't hold sway with the government. So we can't influence any of these things, really. But we can with just sort of being good conduits for the information and putting it out there.
So, yeah, and you know, it doesn't mean I'm hopeless. I really am not hopeless at all. But I really do think that, you know, in the final analysis, what it's going to take is a product or products on the market. I can't think of anything that, you know, you can have great reports, you can have great papers, you can have great experiments, but those just have such a narrow appeal. It's just, you know, it's unusual for people to be interested in reports and experiments. But when you start talking about products, that's when people start taking notice. And we need to get to that point before this field really will get the attention it needs.
All right. Well, with that, why don't we talk about the commercial scene then a bit and sort of the landscape of that. And so you can start with whoever you want to and sort of give a brief summation of what they're doing, what progress you think they've made, what they haven't made, and if they're going to actually succeed. And I know that's a lot, but do what you can.
Well, it's a good question. And I don't know of too many prospects out there for commercial products at the moment outside of the ECAT. I mean, we do know that Leonardo Corporation is now tied up in this big lawsuit with Industrial Heat, and that could have a very stifling effect. I hope it doesn't, but I think it's possible that that could have a stifling effect on getting these products into the market. Then we also have Brillo Incorporation, who they keep trying to open up, and they are still in the research and development phase. I don't know if there's anything commercial on the horizon at this point. I think they're still needing funding for that. And then there are other companies that you hear about which seem to be built around intellectual property. For example, there's the Niche Energy, I believe, is based on Piantelli's work in Italy. There's a company called Clean Planet in Japan. But again, you just don't get the feeling that they're ready to put anything out into the marketplace. And then you get, you know, there are a lot of independent researchers who I think probably have commercial ambitions, but I think anyone who's got commercial ambitions is probably keeping things close to their chest at the moment. So, you know, you don't hear very much about that, but we're not there yet. And I hope we get there before too long. I think once a product is available on the marketplace that people can see without any kind of, you know, because they can see it's obviously working, then I think we're going to be entering into a race, just like we've seen in other areas, like the automotive industry back in the turn of the century, back in the early 1900s, or aviation or computers. I definitely think we could see something similar in this field, but we're not there yet.
I mean, I always think that possibly, yes, in Asia, for example, they have an on-again, off-again relationship with cold fusion, very much so since 89. And places like, or companies like Mitsubishi and so on have funded serious research into basic research. But, I mean, they're interested in fuel. And, I mean, it's something that's on their radar, and they know it's not junk. And so cold fusion has a decent reputation in a lot of these laboratory environments or this laboratory, whatever, culture. And it still gets bounced around and played with. I mean, I don't think they know what they're doing with it always, but there's always that seed too, just bouncing around these random big companies that we don't even know is really looking at it because they don't publicize it at all. And I think that's always going on too. So there's always a stew of activity that humans can never put all their eyes on.
And then you never know what's going on in some of the big government labs. I mean, the Navy has been probably the biggest funder of LENR research over the years. And the report recently that came out from the U.S. Defense Threat Reduction Agency released or had a report published on under their agency. It was not written by, I don't think it was written by members of their agency, but anyway, there has been funding in the U.S. government for cold fusion research, and there are researchers who have reported success within their work within the government. But I don't know how deep it's gone. I don't know if there is a great secret program going on in the U.S. government for cold fusion. I suppose it's feasible, but I'm not terribly convinced that there is. It might be just something they dabbled in.
But like you said, the Navy is probably the biggest that we know about, and I'm on the same page.
Yes.
I doubt it, but it's a basic research level. they're definitely trying, and or at least, again, it's bouncing around here and there and interesting. And some of the Navy research that came out of those, it's some of the best, like the work of Pam Boss and Mel Miles and other scientists, I'm forgetting off the top of my head, have done such amazing work and have been recognized within our niche community for sure, but they probably won't be recognized in their lifetimes outside of it. It's interesting. It's really interesting to, as a whatever, we've come to the conclusion that we believe in the science, like not a naked belief, but it's based on facts, like any scientific belief or any belief.
Right.
But the research that was done there is excellent, and it's just more stuff that's given me confidence to give myself over. So, okay, let's move on with this. We know. We don't have to question this anymore.
Right.
And so, it's too bad there's not a reactor coming out, but...
No, I don't think it's a matter of just having blind faith. I think there's plenty of evidence for it. I don't know if there are many young people interested in this field.
I agree. That's something that concerns me. Because there have been some sort of, like, open source projects. There was one in Italy, for sure, that I remember from a year or two ago, or a couple years back now.
Yes.
And, you know, they were producing excess heat in cells. It was actually a really impressive effort. But, I mean, it wasn't furthering anything. It was just proving basic concepts for people that had never seen it before in an open source way. And that was nice. But, yeah, it's like, that's a blip on the radar.
So, yeah, as far as young people, I did a poll on my website a couple of years ago, just asking people how old they were. It was definitely people who were interested in this field were not people who were under 30 years of age. The majority of people were between 50 and 70 years old.
And,
that probably makes sense if you think about the age of people who were excited about it when Hans and Fleischmann came along.
Mm-hmm.
They grew old with it, but it's just not the kind of startup that you hear about in the tech centers of the world, young people getting really excited about cold fusion. And so I hope that would change. It really would be nice to see a great interest in a younger generation.
Well, like you said, I mean, it's got to get picked up a little bit by someone that's mainstream and, like, make it clear what it's about. Because in my eyes, a lot of what cold fusion now is about research into nanotechnology and extending quantum electrodynamics and these other things about what really defines a chemical reaction in an open system and so on. There's all sorts of interesting scientific questions for young people to get excited about that just doesn't have to be string theory or fusion or hot fusion, or whatever what I consider dead end projects, even if they're great art projects in and of themselves, they're dead ends. So it's like, if that was made clear and talked about in a better, but again, that's like, still, it's putting the cart before the horse, because maybe we need something else first.
Like I said, I think, I really think that it's going to take a product to get hit the next level of interest.
I agree. And why don't we then chat just a bit it's a long affair over the last 6 years of Andrea Rossi and the energy catalyzer.
Yes.
But you said you came into it around 2011, and that's what caught your attention. So why don't you just give us an idea for the people that are listening, because we've been dropping his name and saying, well, yeah, he's opened up the space, so we can, you know, talk about the story for a bit here towards the end and give people an idea of, yeah, what this is about.
Well, January 2011, Rossi went public with a press conference with he and his colleague, Sergio Forcardi, who is a physicist from University of Bologna. And, you know, I think Forcardi is probably the most important witness of the ECAT that we've had, because he's a man who, very respected physicist in his field. And towards the end of his life, he'd worked with Piantelli earlier, became a friend and partner with Rossi. And basically, he's was fully behind. He's never wavered about anything that his work with Rossi. He says that Forcardi said that this was the future of energy. So that was back in 2011. I think Forcardi died in 2012. So pretty soon after that. And then Rossi himself, you know, over the years, since then, he has given or he's provided access to other people to look at the ECAT, not just himself. And there has been some reports that have been written. There was the Levy and Swedish physicists who have worked with the ECAT. And I believe that there's been enough witnesses of this technology to, as far as I'm concerned, that the device is real, that it does produce a great deal of excess heat. But then, you know, with Rossi, he's very, very protective of his technology. He really doesn't want to. I think he's very, very worried about competition. He doesn't want his competitors to get any advantage from seeing his technology up. I think he tries to hide his information as much as possible. So, you know, he's a big mystery man in many ways, and that makes a lot of people skeptical, which I understand. But, you know, for myself, the evidence that I've seen and learned over the years is there's nothing that has given me pause to think that he's just a big fraud. I really do not believe that. I think he's got what he claims, but I think his commercial strategy is such that he's just giving very, very little away. He's wrapped up in a big lawsuit with his former U.S. partners, which I think was a great disappointment for many people, because they were hoping that there could be some help there to get this into the mainstream. But the court case is, from what I can see, it's going to go on for a long time and it's going to cost a lot of money, and hopefully it doesn't bring this thing to a halt.
For me, while we're in that limbo again, it's what do we focus on? It's okay, let's take what we know up to now and some of the Rossi. The most recent one was the Lugano test in a pretty well-equipped lab in Switzerland, a third-party test. It was funded, I believe, right, by Industrial Heat to be sure that what they were buying was not a total piece of shit. And maybe I'm wrong on who funded it. But anyway, it was run by competent people. They brought in a lot of folks that are professionals, and they looked at it pretty closely. And there have been questions about certain things about the apparatus, like was it properly, you know, monitored in this way, et cetera, et cetera. And anyone that wants to can go and decide for themselves, because Frank and I cannot tell you what to think on this matter. It's like, it has a lot of ebbs and flows to it. And it's interesting enough to get into, period, whether you decide or not what to believe about it. There seems to have been produced some evidence of like what was the ash that came out of that reactor, I think is still interesting and worth discussing. And just the fact that so many people, yeah, have looked at it closer than so many other sort of reactors or whatever claim to be free energy machines and other basically fakes. And it's just like, this has produced some really interesting things that even though, like, yeah, it's still not convincing the skeptics, and I'm still not 100% convinced of anything. It's like, I'm still following it, and those certain events and experiments have like impressed me, and people that have looked at it have impressed me. But I also still have serious questions as well. But it's fascinating, and it is part of the history of this subject now, and it's like anyone should know about it and decide for themselves.
I understand skepticism. I guess my conviction comes not just from what Rossi himself says, that would be silly to believe just somebody because of what they say. But I think it's people who've been in contact with him, people who have been with him in experiments, people who have worked with him. And personally, like I said, I've no reason to believe that it does not produce a great deal of excess energy. The evidence to me seems to suggest that it very much does. But like I said earlier, we don't know what the end result's going to be practically and commercially. That has to be played out yet. I mean, you could have the greatest technology in a laboratory, and then it could be a total commercial flop for whatever reason. So, I don't think the future is secure at this point, but I'm hopeful. I do have hope, but it's not guaranteed. I think what I've witnessed and I communicate with a lot of people via my website and other means. I know that there is a great deal of interest amongst a certain group of people. They're not necessarily a single group, but there are certain people who are very, very interested in this and who are pushing very hard to try and understand it and try and replicate it. And I have a lot of hope for those reasons. I think there are going to be more experiments taking place, more sophisticated experiments taking place. I think there's going to be more discussion, more discoveries. So I think there's a momentum that has built amongst a small community of serious researchers who are convinced that there is something that's worth looking into with a great deal of potential. And so that makes me hopeful.
And maybe the last question or topic or whatever we want to consider it to get into quickly is you as an amateur, Frank, and I'm an amateur in basically everything I cover. What do you say to people that are getting into subjects that are like they're new to them or they're not really interested? What is the value of it for you? What do you think you bring to the table as someone that's, from the outside looking in that then like takes it up? Or what is the value of that?
What I have learned is for myself is don't take things at face value just because of what certain authorities in the field might say. I've learned enough for myself to have to actually feel perfectly fine disregarding what someone in authority, i.e. in the mainstream of science or media, might say on a topic. I really have learned to think for myself and to look at evidence for myself and not to feel like I am a stupid person for disbelieving what someone who may be very prestigious might say. So my feeling is that we've really got to look at things without prejudice, look at the evidence clearly, and make your own decisions on these kinds of topics.
So in wrapping up, Frank, maybe you can give us a little insight into where you think the website is going. Do you have any other plans, creative plans otherwise?
I don't think the website's going to go anywhere very much different. There's always a time constraint. I've got other obligations in my life. So, I cannot devote 100% of my daylight, my waking hours to the site, although that would be very wonderful if I could. But, I've got other things I have to do. But having said that, I'm very much committed to keeping the site going. I will say that the site is very much driven by events rather than trying to set an agenda. It's hard to set an agenda in this field, especially when so many things are out of one's own control. You can just kind of follow what's going on and try and highlight the important things that are happening. And I will continue to do that. And I will say, if it was not for the readers of my site and the readers who comment and bring a lot of very interesting insights and information, my site would be very, very much poorer if it wasn't for those contributors. I mean, I've learned so much from everyone who has made contributions to the site over the years. So it's a real group effort. I feel like, I can host a website and I can, make it available for commenters. And that seems to be probably, in my mind, 90% of the value of the site comes from those people who comment and bring ideas to the site.
I totally agree. When I do choose to participate in those sorts of conversations. I'm choosy about where I do it, and your site is one of them, especially when I was really focused on the subject matter, which I'm not so much anymore. But I will say, yeah, I agree 100%. That is such a great value of the site. And the monitoring is very well done, so there's not any trolling. And the people are that do regulate.
That's one thing that I take that seriously. I take moderation seriously. Some people disagree with the way I do it, and that's fine, but I wouldn't want to do it any other way than the way I've been doing it over the years. And
I mean, if anyone wants to cry censorship, they haven't spent enough time in an internet forum. They just haven't. They don't understand the garbage dump that it can be and the amount of bullshit that is like just thrown in there by a bunch of people that can hide behind a fake avatar and just say whatever the hell they want and spout off however they want. And we call that an opinion that should be heard. No, not if it's like my forum and it's playing by my rules, which it is. It's yours. It's no one else's. So it's ridiculous to ever be criticized for something like that, because anyone that has any experience in forums knows it's a necessity.
And if I'm going to do it, I want to do it in a way that I feel comfortable with, and that's kind of what's been my guiding principle.
And it's a group effort, man. We're all doing this together. We're all learning from each other. I gain a lot of value. The Cold Fusion 10 is a big one, and it's cool. And people they really care about humanity. You know, that's why we're all doing this, I think. We care about...
That's why I'm doing it.
We care about, we want them. Yeah, yeah. And because I could really care less about energy in a lot of ways, in a certain way, because I think that humans are just going to sort of like blow themselves up with it anyway, right? But I also know that it's like, yes, even if we're not ready for something, it's the future needs a chance to like grapple with it better than how we grapple with it. Like, we're not going to be around forever, but there's going to be new humans, and they have a chance.
Right.
They totally do.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to do, is just lay the groundwork for that.
Yep.
So, Frank, with that, I will let you go, and I will give you thanks once again, and your insight has been invaluable, and thank you for participating in this dialogue.
Well, thank you. So I've enjoyed chatting with you, John.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.